Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokesman.com.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, that show that isn't afraid of anything in particular, unless it's concern over the safety of its prima donna, Mary Pat Truthart, who is absent this week as she tours the countryside of Peru. Que te vaya bien, MP. Anyway, that leaves Nathan and I on our own to debate the relative qualities of two movies that we're faced with this week. The first is Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Tim Burton's sequel to his 1988 effort that bears only a single Beetlejuice as its title, and that sees Michael Keaton return as one of his most outrageous screen characters. The second is Strange Darling, a title that gives only a slight indication of its plotline, an ultra-creepy exploration of a serial killer's mind. Let's begin with a film sequel that, opening three decades or more after the original, still has something of a familiar feel. That's because the title character of Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, be careful not to say it a third time, is played by Michael Keaton in much the same way he did all those years ago. While he is the titular character, though, Beetlejuice is only a supporting player. The main storyline involves another couple of familiar faces, both of whom appeared in the first film, Lydia, played by Winona Ryder, and Lydia's stepmother, Delia, played by Catherine O'Hara. They are joined by Jenna Ortega, who plays Lydia's angry teen daughter, Astrid, and Justin Theroux, who plays the unctuous producer of the I See Ghosts TV show that Lydia is the star of. The plot that director Burton follows involves Lydia ultimately asking Beetlejuice to help in saving her daughter, even while he is being pursued both by his former witch of a wife, played by Monica Bellucci, and by underworld forces led by an actor posing as a cop played by Willem Dafoe. None of it seems new. The special effects are terrific, though, and what Burton has put on the screen does evoke the occasional guffaw, such as the extended story that Beetlejuice recites totally in Italian. By the end of Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, I realized that I was smiling, surprised but pleased that I'd at least gotten my money's worth, and that Burton had returned to making movies that were a better balance between comedy and dark emotions.
Well, I think we can take a little bit of time here to talk about Tim Burton and his strange career, but just talking about this movie, Beetlejuice, the 1988 original, is a childhood favorite of mine. That was on regular rotation on my visit to the video store. I rented it so many times because it did kind of walk that line between horror and comedy that worked really well when you're a kid, because it's just scary enough, but not too scary that it inspires nightmares, at least not in me. And of course, there was a Beetlejuice cartoon show that was just for kids. So, you know, Beetlejuice did kind of have a life of his own after the movie. And there have been rumors of a Beetlejuice sequel for a long time. I remember reading about Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian, which was supposed to be the sequel back in the 90s. They've been trying to get this off the ground for a long time. And yet, even though I do have nostalgic fondness for the original, I wasn't exactly clamoring for this, because we've seen these kinds of movies, these legacy sequels, these long delayed follow-ups so many times now.
And even though many of them are failures.
A lot of them are, yeah. And it's just calling back things. Remember this? And Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice has some of that, but I was actually pleasantly surprised by this movie too. I had a good time, even though I do think it's about half as good as the original Beetlejuice, which I did rewatch the other night. And again, it's just so insane to me that that is Tim Burton's second feature film as a director.
Right.
He made Pee-wee's Big Adventure, and then a few years later, he made that. And just
this was a preview to the two films that really, really made him.
Batman and Edward Scissorhands.
And Edward Scissorhands.
Yes, and it's still such a joy to watch. But I did appreciate that this sequel, because it's not like a reboot or a reimagining, it is a sequel. I appreciated that it isn't just a mere recitation of the original. And you mentioned that flashback that's done entirely in Italian and is about the plague. It has a lot of other kind of nice, weird touches. There's this other flashback scene that's done in claymation, which, you know, of course, calls back some of Burton's own animated films, that explains the fate of the character played by Jeffrey Jones, who is not in this movie because he has done some very bad things in real life. And so I thought that was kind of a clever workaround. There's an homage at the end of the movie to the final dream sequence in Brian De Palma's film Carrie. The Carrie music came in and I said, oh, okay, I think I know what he's doing here. And because the ghosts in this world apparently love to possess the living and make them do elaborate choreographed dance numbers. We saw that in the first one. Here there's a big musical set piece that I don't want to spoil, but is set to a very strange musical selection.
So I guess what you're saying here is that people are going to want to watch this movie more than once to catch all the Easter eggs.
There's a lot of stuff going on in it. Yeah. And again, like, I feel like Burton has been sleepwalking through a lot of his recent movies. There doesn't seem to be any joy in the last, I don't know, 8 to 10 feature films he's made, with a few exceptions in there. But this really feels like he's having fun for the first time in a long time.
Yeah, I agree.
And just a surprise that that fun is happening in the midst of a, you know, long-delayed Beetlejuice sequel.
Yeah. The movies that we talked about, you know, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, then Beetlejuice, but particularly Batman. The original Batman, to me, was, it came seemingly out of nowhere, and it changed everything. Mm-hmm. It changed the whole route, the whole thought about what Batman was on the big screen, because before that, we'd all only thought about Adam West and bang, bang, pow, wow, TV stupid stuff. And it was interesting that everyone questioned at the time, why did he cast Michael Keaton? And of course, Keaton was terrific as that Batman. But then he went on and made Edward Scissorhands immediately afterwards, and it was like, we've announced now there is a new guy in Hollywood and this guy is good. But it just seemed like from that point on, it was, I don't know, there was Mars Attacks and all these other movies. But then when he started teaming up with Johnny Depp after Edward Scissorhands, and he did Dark Shadows,
Alice in Wonderland,
and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the sense of fun wasn't really there. I mean, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is nothing like the Gene Wilder version.
Well, and you also start to see Tim Burton kind of retreating into that, we're just in weird CGI land mode. I mean, and you haven't called out my favorite Tim Burton movie, although I do love Pee-wee, but Ed Wood, I think, is maybe his magnum opus. It's all of his themes and all the stuff he likes to explore in one really brilliantly realized movie. I also think it's probably Johnny Depp's best performance. But with Beetlejuice, even though I think there is probably a lot of CGI going on in this movie, there's also a lot of that kind of handmade, deliberately creaky B-movie special effects stuff going on here. Mm-hmm. So there are practical effects. There are latex creatures that look like latex creatures. And all
poor
of this
Bob.
Fun.
I was sad
Bob
for
Bob.
Bob
is a great little character. And so there's a lot of invention there, even though it is calling back images from the original Beetlejuice. I mean, just every time you go into that supernatural waiting room and all the new characters that pop up waiting on that, you know, on those couches in there, there's lots of fun stuff kind of happening in the background. But I do want to talk about the screenplay for this movie. And it was written by the guys that created the Wednesday Netflix series, which has Jenna Ortega and was directed in part by Tim Burton.
And it was completely different team, writing team, than did the original.
Right. Yes, exactly. I just think the screenplay is extremely busy in a way that's almost kind of amusing unto itself, because the third act feels like they're doing like traffic control. You can almost picture the writer's room with all their note cards on the wall.
Exactly.
Going, how do we get all these pieces to come together? It's like every idea they had about a Beetlejuice sequel over the last 36 years, they're all kind of crammed in here. And some of the subplots just get wrapped up so abruptly that you think, why did they even bother with that if that's just how they were going to do it? And then you have Monica Bellucci, who is Tim Burton's partner in real life. And she looks great. She looks like Morticia Adams, but she's got all these staples holding her body parts together. And they set her up as this really cool villain. She's like a soul taker. And, you know, you see her origins in that flashback we referenced earlier. But I don't think the movie ever does anything with her, really. Mm-hmm. She has that presence and she has that menace. And then it doesn't really fulfill that potential. And then you've also got the subplot with Jenna Ortega and her new boyfriend. That's just one of the many subplots, which has a nifty little twist in it, but also doesn't really go anywhere. It's all these ideas that just kind of feel, you know, only half fleshed out or unrealized, even though everything around him is pretty fun and colorful and relatively entertaining.
But what you bring up, I mean, what you're mentioning there brings up the notion, which I felt at the end, oh, they're setting us up for a sequel. There's going to be a Beetlejuice.
Yeah.
Beetlejuice.
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh.
Is he in the room?
Yeah.
Well, and, you know, we haven't talked about perhaps the main attraction of this movie, which is Beetlejuice himself and Michael Keaton. And I just, you know, this is one of those performances, and I'm sure it's tied to some kind of nostalgia. I'm just as susceptible to it as anyone. his performance just makes me laugh. Mm-hmm. Even these dumb, he's basically a Catskills comedian, yep. Beetlejuice. He's doing these dumb jokes. And just the way that Michael Keaton throws himself into this character, yep. he hasn't missed a beat. And he's in that original Beetlejuice movie for like 15 minutes, mm-hmm. maybe even less. And he's definitely more front and center in this sequel, but they still know to pull back occasionally. Like, mm-hmm. let's not let Beetlejuice overstay his welcome. Mm-hmm. And so there are long passages of the movie where he's not in it. And right. I think that's just right. Also, it's great to see Winona Ryder and Catherine O'Hara, who I think are doing pretty good work in this movie, even though, you know, the spotlight's constantly being yanked away from them. And yeah. Catherine O'Hara has some good one-liners.
And Jenna Ortega holds up also. Yeah, yeah. I mean, fresh off Wednesday. I mean, mm-hmm. she's a fresh presence. Well, and we should mention that it's Arthur Conti plays her boyfriend counterpart mm-hmm. here. But speaking of Keaton, I think we all forget that he began as a stand-up comedian. Yeah. And we go back to some of his best roles. For example, in Night Shift, yeah. where he played Billy Bezhowski.
It's like his first movie.
And that's where he just jumps off the screen at you. So he's played his share of dramatic roles over the years, but I think this is the kind of thing he does best.
And another childhood favorite, Mr. Mom. I always liked that movie when I was a kid. I don't know if it's any good. But yeah, I mean, I think that it's maybe – I don't think that this is a great movie by any means.
No, no.
It feels like – I don't want to say that Burton has his groove back, but he's on his way to getting his groove back, I
and
think.
It,
and this is more his speed than some of the things he's been doing
and
lately.
If nothing else, it's a decent summer movie.
Yeah.
And you know, you may want to think twice about taking your very young children to it, but
I was surprised. There's some blood and guts in this. It really leans into the spookiness of it. I liked that about it, too.
Yeah. At any rate, that was our discussion of Beetlejuice. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to tackle J.T. Molnar's thriller, Strange Darling. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Nathan Weinbinder and I, besides moaning about the absence of our third partner, Mary Pat Truthart, the two of us discussed Tim Burton's sequel, Beetlejuice. Let's now turn to something original by a filmmaker, J.T. Molnar, in only his second big screen release. That something is titled Strange Darling, and is written and directed by Molnar, and acted primarily by Willa Fitzgerald and Kyle Gallner. It does have a chilling sense of the strange. Part of that sense involves the characterizations put in by Fitzgerald as someone identified only as the lady and Gallner as the demon. Both are relatively fresh-faced, veteran actors, though new to starring roles, and both acquit themselves well. The other more important aspect to what Molnar has done is play with chronology. Though told in six chapters, with an epilogue, Molnar, after a credit sequence that features a panicked woman running slow-mo directly toward us, throws us squarely into the middle of the narrative, specifically in Chapter 3, titled, Can You Help Me, Please?, and continuing, out of context, the rest of the way. Explaining why it gives away too much of what Molnar has planned, so we'll do our best to avoid providing any spoilers. I will say, though, because of the performances, both by the leads and by some of the other supporting roles, Ed Begley Jr. for one, a virtually unrecognizable Barbara Hershey for another, not to mention Molnar's control over the narrative, it's easy to ignore the fact that ultimately Strange Darling is basically an exercise in horror with little or nothing to say about the larger issues that it so clearly loves to exploit. But merely dancing with a cinematic devil is at times plenty fulfilling and scary enough.
Well, I do think it's playing around with themes of gender roles and role playing and sort of how we fall into those things and make assumptions about them. And again, I'm talking in circles around the plot of Strange Darling because the whole appeal of this movie is going and not knowing where it's going to take you.
That's right. And it is playing with all the standard tropes we've known and we've been familiar with about serial killer movies over decades.
And it's taking advantage of that fact.
Exactly.
And then, you know, trying to pull the rug out from under you. And it is ultimately, I think, a movie about the convolutions of its own plot. Because as you mentioned, And it also starts with a lot of like big kind of stylistic swings. Like you have the title card that says Strange Darling, and then underneath it says a thriller in six chapters. And there's another title card that says shot entirely in 35mm film.
Yeah, right.
So you're like, it's got these like movie nerd bona fides at the top, right? And I almost kind of wanted to push back against those. But, you know, hey, it's kind of cool that they shot this movie in 35mm, so I guess I'll go with it. I also want to mention, this is maybe the biggest twist of the movie, the cinematographer on this movie was Giovanni Ribisi, the, you know, veteran character actor who, this is his first feature behind the camera, and does a really good job.
Really
this
good
movie
job.
Is
yes.
really well made. Yeah. It has way more style and energy in the visuals than so many mainstream movies we see that had probably 20 times the budget.
And,
that
you know,
this
the thing
has.
You didn't mention is there's a couple of times in which it fades to black and white out of the color.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's another.
And I was thinking a lot about Kill Bill Volume 2, especially, which has those, you know, it's kind of told out of order and has those black and white interstitials. It opens with this on-screen text and this foreboding voice telling us this is a dramatization of real crimes. I was, of course, thinking of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which starts that same way. But I think that when you start a movie, they tell you there's going to be six chapters, and then it starts at chapter three, goes to chapter five, and then back to chapter one again. It's pretty obvious that it's trying to hide something from us. And so I don't know if you had this experience, but my brain starts working overtime trying to think, okay, what are they hiding? And I had seen the buzz for this movie because it's kind of already got like a little cult following, Strange Darling. I was told before going in, like, don't read anything about it. Just go in cold and let it happen. And so, of course, I'm like, all right, it's playing a game with me. And I think it was about halfway through chapter one when I figured out what it was up to, where I thought, okay, I think I know what the twist, for lack of a better term, is. But the movie has a lot more up its sleeve. In my review for the radio, I kind of described it as basically like watching someone play a three-card Monty game, or where you're you're the one that's paid in and you're getting kind of fleeced. So it is manipulating us. And I do wonder if this would work a second time. Once you know where it's going, does it still work? Would it have the same impact? And I don't know, because I've only
Good
seen
question.
It the one time. But, you know, for this kind of a grindhousey thriller with two really good performances, and we can talk about those. Yeah, I had a good time with this. And again, the style of it, I think, really makes it something worth watching, because you just think, you know, what are they going to show me next? Along with where is this story going to go?
When I walked out, the first thing I thought of were two words. I said, a clever curiosity.
Yeah.
It really is very clever in how it does. Clever in a way that, as you point out, I think you got ahead of me. I don't think it was until I got to the fourth chapter that I went, all right, now
which
I
the fourth
see.
Chapter in the chronology is actually the fourth chapter.
Yeah.
Because it goes, so I've got the list here. It goes chapter 3, 5, 1, 4, 2, 6.
Yeah, and then
and
the
then
epilogue.
You've got an epilogue.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's all kind of but jumbled up on purpose.
I purposely talked about these two character actors. I was not familiar with either of them.
Okay.
And you know, I know that they've got a lot of credits. You look on IMDb, they've done a lot of work. But much of it's on television and probably programs that I've never watched. I wasn't familiar with either of them, and yet they did a really good job. On one hand, I thought they're both really fine actors. At the same time, they had this fresh face about them that I appreciated. It's like, ooh, let's bring new talent in. It's not the same old people, you know?
And you're talking about Willa Fitzgerald and Kyle Gallner are the stars of Strange Darling. I was not familiar with her. Kyle Gallner has sort of been cropping up in a lot of these kind of edgy indie thrillers, and he usually plays scumbags. So I think the movie is also kind of playing off, if you have knowledge of the kinds of roles he tends to play, it's also playing off of that knowledge. And I agree with you that I think their performances are really rich, again, in ways that we can't really talk about. Because if you talk about how they're digging into these characters, it gives away the whole game. But
let's just say that Kyle Gallner has the demon, he's called, as a porn star mustache. So that lets
well,
you know.
And I also wondered, well, and there is sort of that kind of scuzzy 70s, 80s drive-in feel to the whole movie, to the point that I wondered, what decade is this even set in?
Yeah.
Because it starts with her driving in like a Pinto, like a vintage Pinto.
Yeah.
And then later on, he's in a newer looking truck, but you think, okay, but how new is it?
Yeah.
And then eventually someone has a smartphone and you realize, okay, so this is set you know, the 21st century. But it's certainly beholden to, you know, I mentioned Tobe Hooper films. It's beholden to a lot of those things.
Mm-hmm.
But I also don't think that those movies in the 70s or 80s were, this is definitely a postmodern Western kind of thing. It's that post-Pulp mm-hmm. Fiction, post-Memento mm-hmm. kind of the fascination with, I'm going to tell this story, but if I tell it out of standard chronological order, it brings a whole new level of complexity to it. I also was wondering what would happen if you were to put this in chronological order. I was kind of doing a thought experiment, but then I thought, that's not really the point of the mm-hmm. movie. The point of the movie is that it is out of order, and that's how it's got to be.
And, you know, even though the conceit is telling the story out of order, even within that, there are surprises that
For
just
sure.
kind of come out of left field.
Because even though I kind of figured out that central twist, there were things that happened after that revelation that I did not see coming, mm-hmm. and you wouldn't be able to see coming.
Right.
Like, for
right.
example, there's a moment where the lady opens up the demon's wallet, and the thing that she finds in there is a surprise. And
to her, yes.
And to us.
Yes,
and
yeah,
it,
yeah.
And it takes both of those characters in unexpected directions. So
right.
there are little things like that that don't feel like contrivance. They
no.
feel like, okay, that's an interesting, you know, wrinkle to this plot I was not expecting.
There are also, which is a point that I tried to make about Beetlejuice in the first half of the show, there are moments, not very many of them, but there are moments of humor too.
Oh, for
with,
sure.
With Ed Begley and, yeah. and Barbara Hershey. Barbara Hershey, I kept saying, who is that? And it wasn't until the end I went, of course, it's Barbara Hershey. But there's a moment in which someone yells out, he's got a gun. And another guy comes out of nowhere and goes, well, I do too. And it's
yeah.
like, that's random.
Also, the breakfast that they eat at the beginning is its own kind of little comedy.
Right. And we should point out what it's supposed to be in Oregon someplace.
I think so, yeah. And I'll say with Willa Fitzgerald, who I think is maybe the least known of the four main actors in this, there's one scene near the end of the movie, this really long, unbroken take of
yes.
her that has no dialogue. It's just physical, and it's really good, and it ties mm-hmm. up the whole movie. And so, yeah, I think curiosity is right, and it's very violent. Not, well, I don't want to say it is kind of explicitly violent
yeah,
in some places.
Is.
But yeah, I would say hopefully we've talked around it enough so that you're curious to see the curiosity,
yeah.
but we didn't spoil too much of it because it does rely on those cascading twists that
it happens. It is also something that you may revisit in your nightmares, I'll tell you. At any rate, that was our discussion of Strange Darling. This is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and early in the show, Nathan Weinbinder and I discussed Tim Burton's Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. Let's take this moment to thank Cassie Fox for both producing and engineering the show. And we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer, wherever we can find it. Until then, consider these words from filmmaker Jordan Peele. Part of what horror is taking risks and going somewhere that people think you're not supposed to be able to go in the name of expressing real-life fears. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.